Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to HJT Design Radio Straight Talk, a show dedicated to exploring all aspects of creating a great dental office, where the only dumb question is the question that's not asked. Here's Jim and Han.
Good evening. Jim Jervis here, along with my co-host, Han Tran. Han, how are you this evening?
Absolutely fantastic, Jim. Just fantastic. How are you?
Doing okay. Yep, doing all right. Obviously, like everybody, we're kind of hunkered down, figuring out what's going to happen next, and we understand that, so we'll just kind of see what happens. But obviously tonight, we're doing our Straight Talk show, and we're on episode number 97, which means we're quickly screaming towards that 100th episode. I hope everyone had a chance to listen to last week's episode in the new program that we had a chance to launch and talk with the representative of the investor development group. That was a pretty interesting program and show. But tonight we're gonna talk about some technical stuff. Let's talk about punch list, as-built, final draws, all that kind of stuff that happens towards the end of a project. And then part two of the show, we're going to have a quick discussion about some new sterilization items that you might want to check into for your facility. But again, welcome, and let's just kind of just dive into it. Han, I know you and I for the last several weeks have been talking through punch list items on one of our projects. And so let's kind of just jump into that, and I'll let you start out with what the heck is a punch list? It has nothing to do with voting, yeah. I'm sure.
Well, it's not as controversial, let's say, okay? A punch list is basically items that are still outstanding, whether it's items that have not been completed on the project, or items that that was done that are not up to par and need to be redone. A little adjustment, a little touch up. Sometimes it could be big things. Sometimes it's just minor touch of paint. I know that, Jim, correct me if I'm wrong, I think a punch list doesn't necessarily keep you from getting your certificate of occupancy as long as the items on a punch list does not involve life safety type of items or issue. Am I correct on that?
That's correct. As long as an item that is non-life safety, meaning something that's covered by or required by the code or the governmental agency, as long as that is not on the punch list item, an incomplete punch list or an unfinalized punch list that is just, I want to use the word cosmetic or non-life safety issues, will not preclude you from getting your CO. You can get final certificate of occupancy from the building official and the governmental agencies if there's slight dings in the wall, bad paint drips, the wrong carpet installed, the stain on this particular carpet. We got a slice or a scratch in this countertop. Those are just a real quick nutshell of just some of the things that come about on a punch list. Now, if there is a punch list item that says the panty hardware is not installed or the door leading to this particular area does not function properly or there's no door closer on a door that has to have a closer because it's a fire-rated door. Those things are life safety issues. There's no strobe alarm. There's no emergency egress lighting, or the lighting that is installed doesn't work properly, or the fire extinguishers haven't been hung. Those things will stop you. They will stop you in your tracks from getting your CO.
Now, it depends on the scope of the project. So a punch list, if you are doing interior build-out, then the punch list will only usually associate only within the interior of your space. On rare occasion, and we have encountered this on one or two of the projects, it's that, let's say you're in an older shopping street, and the parking space in front of your office, of your new office space, happened to be, let's say, a handicap parking space, and the ramped to get to it, or the striping that designate the unloading area is not current or not up to code and stuff like that. They can include, the building official could include that as part of the requirement that you have to do, and that could be, that could be on the punch list and stuff like that, for you to get done before they actually issue the certificate of occupancy. If you're doing a build up, from the ground up building, then the punch list could be anything from the outdoor into the indoor. It could be trees, additional trees. It could be, painting the curb. Whatever it is, as long as it's not a life safety issue, then you likely will get at least minimum the conditional certificate of occupancy, meaning that if there's item that the code official will want you to do before they issue the final. When you get the conditional certificate of occupancy, it should mean that you have been given the green light to open your office for visitation, but it has condition. Okay, so punch list is one of those things that, most of it is cosmetic. Sometimes it can be, it can be more technical. So it varies, but again, the important thing is it's a list of things that need to be done, and usually the person that's responsible for getting it done is your contractor, and once they get it done to your satisfaction, then that's where you pay them and all that good stuff. Jim, is there...
No, Han, when you say the person that's responsible for getting it done, you mean the person who is responsible for correcting the issues, actually physically doing the repair or the change out or whatever.
Correct.
Yes, the person who's responsible for creating the punch list is actually three people. First, it's you, the owner. It's us, the architect and designer. And thirdly, it's the code official. All three of those entities will create things that could potentially go into the punch list. Now, a lot of times you'll hear, the contractor created the punch list. What's wrong with that?
Let me see. The contractor is usually not very motivated to, to repair anything that they've done. I'm not saying that they're all like that, but it's almost like asking a fox to watch the hen house and don't eat the hen. They,
right.
It's a conflict of interest. It's self-serving for them to do it. Because they, in my opinion, they don't, who's going to hold them accountable for doing everything, 100%.
Right. It's the checks and balances. It's the, It eliminates the checks and balances by letting the contractor creating the punch list. Now, don't get me wrong. There are great contractors out there, and they're great individuals that are very ethical. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that the entity that's responsible were the initial three. Now, are there times that the contractor will give you some items that need to be put into the punch list? And the answer is absolutely. There will be times that he or she is aware of something that maybe some contractor hasn't done and needs to do. That's when you take that and you put it into the punch list. Okay, but the contractor is not the person who's formally responsible for creating it. Now, once that punch list is created at close to the very end of the project, okay, when 99% of the work is done. And you see, that's another thing, timing. Timing on the punch list is crucial. You can't have it done too early, because what you end up having is effectively, 100, 200-page punch list, which is useless. When you have things like, okay, finish this room, or install all the doors, or, those kind of things, that's not punch list item. That's get the work done stuff. That punch list was created way too early. So it has to be done virtually at the end of the project, but not before the contractor says, I'm done, and he starts taking off his crews and demobilizing, meaning, he doesn't have people there on a full-time basis finishing, completing, that kind of stuff, because then you get yourself into trouble, which – how many times have we had this happen, right, Hon? The contractor's done. Yeah. He says he's done. He's walked off the job. He's moved to the next project. And all of a sudden, it's literally like, pulling teeth, to use the vernacular, to get them to come back and finish the things that need to be done. So you're kind of like a dance here to be able to get it done at the right time when the contractor and his crews are still on the job, ready to get the work done.
And Jim, let's say we have an interior build out, and the construction schedule is set for 4 months. Okay, when within that period would you think is the punch list probably will take place or likely to take place?
Close to the very end of the project, probably within 2 weeks of completion, is when I typically start to identify that it's time to be able to do a punch list. So the last 2 weeks of a project, you're usually doing the last little pieces, the cleaning up, the final install of a few little things that need to be done. You're not doing major work. You're not, installing carpet. You're not installing flooring over here, or you're not doing major painting or installing doors. You might be installing a single door because the door was either set wrong, ordered incorrectly, the wrong color, the wrong operation, that kind of stuff. But you're not saying, you're not looking at massive areas. So typically around the 2 week period, about 2 weeks when they're ready to say we're finished with this project. Sometimes later.
Yeah, it's a period of time in the project where I kind of basically like just a mad dash to the finish line. It kind of butt and elbow type of activity. So, Jim, is punch list, is that a additional service to the contract?
No. Punch list is integral to the work that we do. It's part of the construction administration phase that you pay us for to prepare this document, to review the project, go over everything, make sure that it meets the criteria set out in the design drawings, and identify areas where there's failures. And then we create the punch list along with the two other entities that do the walkthrough and the review to make sure. this, don't get me wrong, this is a cohesive list that the contractor has to go down through each one of the items and check them off to our satisfaction. There's something that nasty that happens at the end of it if they don't get it done. And we'll talk about that in the second part of this conversation, but that's kind of the procedure and the process.
Now, there is no, it's not an added cost or service from the construction contractor side, correct?
No. It's part of him or her, the contractor, where they under contract with you, the owner, to produce and build your complete facility to the point that you get your final CO and that everything is done per the construction documents. So final CO is just one item of the construction documents. Again, there could be things that were painted the wrong color. There could be scratches. There could be damages. And see, that's another thing. When I say 2 weeks, Han, when we talk about 2 weeks, typically during that time, that's when you have got the major part of your install work done of all your dental equipment. So your chairs are going in, all of the other stuff that's necessary to get accomplished. Obviously, the contractor is responsible for coordinating them, but other people, other subcontractors are actually doing that work. Now, that's the biggest time that we see dings and damages. Okay, so you'll see dings in walls, damages to door frames, things that are cosmetic, but at the same time need to be repaired. We of course, would not accept that kind of activity and those kind of damages to your new building. So that kind of coordinates nicely with the install of your equipment.
Yeah, it's typically, I've been on project where if the subs or the vendors, equipment installer and stuff like that, doesn't have supervision and or good working relationship with the GC, what you don't want to experience on a job, when it's done, is people pointing finger at who did what. Besides having equipment installed, having the final touches of things and stuff like that, the owner will also be moving his stuff in. And through that process, like you see, things can get dinged up because, sometimes it's avoidable. But through the hustle bustle that people do get a little bit careless, and just touching up the wall, repainting this and that are little things that usually part of the build out. If you have major repair due to I see somebody drop a cabinet and it punched through the wall and stuff like that, that's a different issue, and maybe need to be worked out to see who's who's responsible and stuff like that. But I think that's a little bit beyond the punch list. But there's a lot of, there's a lot of things that can go, that can cause havoc and damage to the building. So ultimately, once it's done, punch list items can proceed beyond you getting your certificate of occupancy and do the final move in. Right, Jim?
Right. I mean, there are times when punch list items require reorder. So, I mean, we've had it happen on some of our other projects. For example, the project here real close to us, pre-finished wooden doors. The doors pre-finished. They were specified as a birch with a natural finish. The doors that came in and were installed were mismatched. So it was kind of like a hit or miss. There was a dark one, there was a light one, there was a medium one, and it's like these doors didn't come from the same lot number. Now, we all know what we mean with lot number. Lot number means they're all produced at the same time, they're all produced using the same kind of materials, the same kind of stain, the same kind of whatever, so that they all work together. So the requirement for that particular punch list item was that the doors needed to be replaced to a common continuous color ration across the board, one lot number. That took 2 weeks for the new product to get in. Well, you're not going to hold up moving into your building for 2 weeks. That's money wasted. So in that particular case, the dentist moved into the building, was seeing patients, and over a weekend when the doors came in, the contractor brought his subcontractor back in, and over the weekend switched out the doors to the satisfaction necessary and got to check that item off the punch list.
Now, Jim, on that particular job, if I'm getting it right, that particular punch list item was done twice.
I didn't want to bring that up, but you're right. It was done twice because the second set of doors that came in were also subpar and inadequate. And so it was like, okay, try it again.
Yeah.
Then it got to be a little adversarial with the contractor because in this case, he was not very happy.
Well, the whole thing is, I think the word kind of subjective is to the owner's satisfaction. And when it's subpar, they have to do it as many times. I find that most of our clients are very reasonable people, and dentists are very reasonable folks. But if it's something that just doesn't look right, feel right, or just not at the quality that that was expected or specified, then if it takes them 3 or 4 times to get it done right, that's what it takes.
Right.
Okay. So exactly. Usually. It's minor things like that are only usually done the first time, but there's very instances where it requires several rounds, and hopefully everybody's still friends after they're done.
Right, and I guess that is a reason, if you want to call it that, to make sure that your design professional is on your project all the way through to the end. We as the designer and the architect, we know what requirements were outlined in the drawings and the specifications for that particular product and products. And so, for example, if you were to try to do it yourself, you may say, well, yeah, that looks okay. Or, that situation, I guess you'd be less in a position to demand the proper thing that you paid for, whereas you let us be the advocate to be able to get that accomplished. There's been lots of times where Han and I go toe-to-toe with a contractor, and that's no problem. We don't care. It's what's right and is what is necessary and what was outlined in the specifications. And if it's not, then two things are going to happen. They're either going to replace it with what's necessary, or there's going to be a adjustment in the final bid or final purchase of that project. So we've had before example here. Let's give an example of a countertop. When we were doing the punch list on a particular dental office, we noticed that the counter in the particular areas were made out of a lower quality MDF product, meaning a pressed wood product, as opposed to what was specified. In this case, what was specified was a marine grade plywood, which was high quality, very durable. It happened to be, I think it was a wet area, and so we wanted to be able to make that. And You know, so it's an inferior product that was being placed. Now, nine times out of ten, no owner would have ever noticed that because it's covered with Formica or plastic laminate. Nobody really noticed what's underneath unless you stick your head under the counter or you know, we have some of our secrets. And you look at those things and identify what was done. Now, the difference financially between the two, it's like night and day. It's like a Volkswagen compared to a Cadillac. And so, you know, that got remedied. But again, you got to be careful of all those things. And that's the kind of stuff that we as the designer, we're getting slightly off on tangent a little bit, but that's the kind of stuff that we pick up. It's necessary. So to make sure you get what you paid for. Now, let's take this discussion a little bit further into what's that thing called as-built drawings, Han?
Oh, as-built. Let me see. As-built is what was done, what was actually built. The term we use as-built are it's either existing drawings that was generated to depict what was what is there currently. For instance, if you are, we're going to take this from the, you know, to the front of the process. You are, let's say you're buying a building, okay, or you, even if you're going to go into a rent, a lease space. One of the things we found, and it's really befuddled me for years, is that when the questions asked of the owner, whether the landlord or the seller, if there's any drawings of the building that they own or the building they're going to sell. And a lot of times the answer is no. And I find that to be really, really unusual because the building, there is very few buildings that we know, unless it's been built around the turn of the century, was built without drawings. Okay, most commercial projects, if not all commercial projects, are built with a permitted set of construction documents. So that construction document is what they built from. Okay, if that is available, then it gives you a good idea what that building is built of. Now, the as-built is the document that dated or that recorded what actually was done when the building is built. In other words, let's say you have a wall that, you know, a room that's supposed to be, say, 12 by 14 feet, you know, in dimension. And during the construction, the owner say, I really don't need a room that big, but we can use an additional 2 feet in the adjacent space because it has more administrative staff and so on. Let's make the room only 10 by 14, okay? That change is recorded on the drawing, whether it's done by hand or done, you know, in CAD. That updated or the final drawings is what is called the as-built drawings. Okay, so if you are in the process of looking to purchase a building, don't forget to ask the question if there is any existing drawings associated with that particular building. Because it would help you.
Preferably the as-built, but Han, preferably the as-built
right.
drawing as opposed
that's correct.
To just the drawings that were created by the design team. Because,
right.
Sure, the design drawings were the design drawings, but there could have been small, unique changes that affect the actual layout. So, if you're buying the property, or if you're leasing the property, but you want to have the necessary documents to give, for example, to Han and I, to do the interior build up from, the best thing to ask for is the as-built drawings. Problem is, like Han's frustration is, nine times out of ten, nobody has them because they don't so you don't go to the trouble of keeping them. And that's another issue altogether. If you do a project and when you do get the as-built drawings, keep them. Put them away. Do what's necessary to keep those things, because that's a valuable document for down the road. And down the road could be what you hand off to your predecessor, or the people that's going to buy the project or the building or the practice out from under you down the road, an associate, whomever. You want to keep those as-built drawings and be able to have those as part of the actual set of documents. It's just been a very useful tool.
Now, yeah. I mean,
here's the question on that as-built stuff, Han. Obviously, the proper way for as-builts to be created is as the project is being built. So, for example, indication of where all the electrical lines are, where all the outlets are, where the plumbing is put under a floor slab, for example, where was it run? Not where it was shown on the drawing, but where was it actually run? Because maybe there was an adjustment. Or the ductwork, how was the actual ductwork laid out? That changes a lot. We see that a lot of times where a HVAC contractor will come in and say, no, I'd rather do the ductwork this way. Okay. Point A to point B is getting the necessary volume of air. Okay. If you can do it a different way than was actually designed and it works, we don't have a problem with that. Our engineers don't have a problem with that. And you as the owner won't have a problem with that. And if everybody likes it and it saves time and energy and money, then hey, great. It's a good thing. But it's gotta be put into the as-built drawings, because you need to know down the road. If you remodel and want to do something, where the heck was that ductwork? Or where is that plumbing line? It's under the slab somewhere.
It helped greatly if it's documented. In today's with the technologies available, some of that question can be answered rather quickly. But again, documentation. I look at as-built drawings like the patient's chart. Okay, in our case, the patient is the building, and you want to know where everything is as much as possible, so that way we know what to do with it if you have to modify it, renovate it, and things of that nature. So I know that there's a lot of paper documents in the practice, and you go, oh my god, I need another roll of drawings. If you have a set of as-built, it only costs you literally pennies to get them scanned. Okay, you get into a digital format, so that way you can put it in storage and safekeeping. As-built drawing is a very, very helpful tool. It's just that we don't see too often, and that's something that that just costs you as the owner, or the new owner, to have it recreate. So it's to your benefit to actually purchase the building with it versus without it. Jim?
So the as-built drawings, which are supposed to be created by the general contractor, which are supposed to incorporate all the adjustments, the changes. Now, one of the things when I say adjustments and changes could be, Han and I originally designed the project, and we specify this type of lavatory or water closet or this type of HVAC unit. But that's not what was bought, and that's not what was installed. Well, you want to know what that is for a lot of reasons, one of which, maintenance on that particular piece of equipment. Let's say you're... air conditioning or heating unit and needs to have annual maintenance done on it. There's instructions, there's booklets, there's parts of the things which we call our shop drawings that typically should be included with the as-built drawings so that you have a complete written paper or electronic understanding or documentation of what all is in your building. You know, we've come back to projects where, for example, there was a heater in a vestibule. Okay. Well, the heater in that vestibule, nobody could tell who the manufacturer was. Nobody could tell who what kind of filter needed to be put into the thing, how it needed to be repaired, because actually it broke, it failed, and information was trying to be gathered on that thing to be able to figure out what part needed to be ordered. Well, nobody had that information. And so it became a logistical nightmare and a pain in the butt for the owner. So that's why you always should demand that you have those, one, the as-built to tell you what was put in place. Because if there was a change order and the change order said, yep, we're going to change the air conditioning unit from X to Y. Okay. What's Y look like? What's all the technical stuff on Y? It's not in the drawings because we designed X. So the as-built stuff should have the Y there, the Y version of that. Does that make sense, huh?
And, yeah. Hey, Jim, so for the as-built, is that an additional service from both the architect and the GC?
Well, the architect doesn't actually do any of the as-built work. That's not our responsibility and or a requirement, and you don't want us doing it. You want the contractor doing the as-built documents because he or she is the one that's intimately on a day-to-day basis aware of everything that was done. Han and I aren't out on your project every day, and we haven't had a project yet that required us to be there on a day-to-day basis. You don't want to pay for that. You have a general contractor who's responsible for the means, methods, and construction of the thing. Sure, we make observations on a periodic basis, but he or she are there on a daily basis, and they should be writing all this down and putting all this onto a set of drawings so that it's all identified. And that should be included as part of their price to build the project. It's not an extra. It shouldn't be coming up as a change order. It shouldn't be, I didn't think of that, or no, I didn't think that was something I had to do. I would like another couple, $2,000 or $3,000 or $4,000 from you, the owner. Our response to that kind of stuff is, no, not acceptable. The owner doesn't need to pay for extra for this stuff. It's part of the normal doing a business in construction.
Good answer, Jim. You have a contractor that tells you that, you know, I've always treated as a soft cost on all my project, and you're responsible for paying me for doing the as-built documentation. Should that be something that you discuss early on? Should that be something that's documented in your specifications? Because, you know, this is the stuff that become very adversarial toward the end of the project. It could be held as a hostage or a negotiation type of advantage over the, you know, the owner, who need to have those documents because the city or the municipality require that as part of their final closing documentation.
Right. I mean, that's a very important part. I mean, obviously, in the design specifications and drawings, but specifically the specifications. We call out that as-builts need to be provided and covered and provided to the owner at the completion of the project. Now, the point that you're bringing out that is a very good one, in some municipalities, the code official, the building official, who is the final person who signs off to give you your construction of occupancy certificate, may in fact require as-built drawings to be on file. So they're going to require as-built drawings, and that's not all code officials, but in some places it is true. And they will not give you your final CO unless you have the as-built drawings created and prepared. So in the scenario you were talking about, Han, where the contractor says, no, I don't provide those, you need to pay me extra for, and we say, no, it's not a legitimate extra, it becomes adversarial because the client is kind of being held hostage because he needs to get his final CO, but the contractor is saying, no, you can't have these as-built drawings until you pay me extra money. And thus he can't get his final CO and get moved into the building. So, yeah, it becomes very adversarial very quickly in that kind of situation. And don't get us wrong. This happens and can happen. Doesn't happen all the time, but it can possibly happen. And you need people like us that are on your side that are helping you get to the point of getting this stuff accomplished and say, along with a good lawyer. Sometimes it gets to that point. On?
Yeah. Don't get us wrong, okay? This is not fear-mongering. This is actual life events. It's a pain in the butt. Asking the question is good, but asking the right question is better. So, you know, what we're sharing with you is that on your project, whoever gets to whoever is responsible for the design work, and whoever is responsible for the construction of your project, need to know, or at least need to be informed that this is what's expected. Do it in writing, so that there is no battle that needs to be done at the end of the project, where you are held hostage for documents needed. In municipal work, they require to have as-built drawings, submitted to them for their records, and the only people that can do that is the contractor.
Right.
Okay.
So one of the things when we create our punch list item is we will have on that punch list item provide the as-built drawings if they haven't been provided already. So, you know, that's something that's on that punch list. Now, as I alluded to in the previous comments, I want to talk about what's considered the final draw. Now, we all know what a draw is. Obviously, that's when the contractor makes an application, preferably the way it's done, be done right, that application comes to us, we approve it, certify it, give it to the client then gives it to his lending agency, they certify it, and then the payment is made to the contractor, along with a whole bunch of other paperwork necessary, like lien waivers and all that kind of stuff. We'll talk about that on another show. But the final draw is what happens at the end of the completion of the punch list. So we have always stood up to the understanding that the final draw is not paid to the contractor until the punch list is completed 100%. Now, that final draw typically is around 10% of the project total cost. So if it's done right. And the reason why it's that high is it's an incentive, financial one, to the contractor to get the stuff done. I mean, typically, a contractor may only make 15% on the project. So if you're holding 10% of his or her contract until everything is completed, that's the majority of their profit on this project. So it's a great incentive for them to quickly and efficiently get the punch list completed, 100% checked off, and then the final draw application can go through and we'll certify it, give it through the process, and he or she will get paid their final amount due. Never, never, ever pay the final draw until that punch list is 100% completed. Now, sure, we've had opportunities or situations where the contractor said, I can't get the punch list 100% completed because I need to order something and it's going to take 4 weeks or it's going to take 6 weeks. All right. During those times, it's not fair for them to be held out for 6 weeks to not get their final draw. So then we have authorized a partial draw that covered everything but the necessary thing that is held out 6 weeks. But that's on a case-by-case basis, not the norm, more than likely, but it has happened before. On?
Yeah, and in this case, you know, just being reasonable, and most of architects are, you work with the team, to make sure that things are done and done fairly. So, again, it is important that you don't pay up front for things that has not been completed. Right, Jim?
Or purchased. That's correct. Well, we've got about 12 more minutes. I wanted to go over a couple things that we're going to call this part two of our show. And it's some interesting stuff that just came to my attention. And Han and I have been reviewing it and looking it over. And I guess to set the preference here of what typically we all know that most people just never wash their hands properly. And especially with everything that's been going on with COVID and all the other guidelines that come from the CDC and all that kind of good stuff. I mean, honestly, to be able to sit there and physically wash your hands for 20 seconds with soap and do it properly and get all the crap that's like under your fingernails and all that kind of stuff. I mean, Han, you were describing it, wasn't it? Under a medical situation, it's a 2-minute hand wash and there's a special set of procedures, right?
Typically, I think that's when you scrub to go into surgery. I could be off a little bit, but I do believe that's a recommended time.
Right.
You scrub with hot water and soap and brush and all that stuff because you want to have a clean hand before you get gloved up.
Right. Now, in this particular case, as a dentist, obviously you may or may not have to get to that level. But a lot of times you are doing the same kind of stuff as some surgeries. You're especially if you're opening up an individual's gum line or those kind of things. So, yeah, you're at that level. Well, what's come to our understanding is a very unique hand sanitization station, for lack of a better term, a generic thing. This is pretty cool. And so to give you the website, and the product is known as Miritech, Meritech. And it's they've got a whole line of products, but specifically their hand washing system. Particularly, I'm looking at the one right now on my screen. It's called the CleanTech 500. This is a self-contained, and by the way, Han and I don't make any money on any of this stuff. We're not getting kickbacks. We're not getting anything from this manufacturer. All we're saying is we want to give this information out for you to look at and see if it's something that you want to look into, because as we look at it, it's a pretty good product and it might be pretty useful. And you all know that my sister is a chemical engineer, biotech scientist with a large pharmaceutical company. And her organization, which is a worldwide organization, are installing these things in all of their plants. It's an interesting thing because it can be like a wall-mounted unit, a unit that's mounted on the cabinet, a freestanding unit. Actually, I think they even have a mobile unit. But effectively, you walk up to this unit, take both of your hands, slide them into the two holes that are there, and inside there's rotating cylinders that have multiple jets of water along with the hand sanitation liquid. They call it the hand hygiene solution, that's mixed together, and it sprays and cleans your hands up to the wrist in 12 seconds. So the process is automatic. You hold your hands there for 12 seconds, and when it's finished through the cycle, it'll stop. You take your hands out, but of course you go on and do what you're going to do. You're either going to dry them or do whatever else you're going to do. But your hands are clean. They say the technology and the laboratory testing, 99.9% sterile, including, as my sister said, the best part, under the fingernails. So all that gunk that, you know, the CDC says you want to wash with soap and water and get under your fingernails and get all that, you know, potential germs and pathogens are eliminated. So we look at this thing and we go, wow, possible application in a dental office? What could it take the place of, huh?
Well,
or
you
at least augment. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I think, you know, we don't, you know, of course, we don't know pricing and stuff like that, but that's a different topic. I think it's a matter of cleanliness, you know, time saving and all that. So I see more in use and application within the clinical area. So, you know, it depends whether you put hand washing sink within the treatment room or within the, you know, within the hallway and things like that. I think it has a great possibility because it doesn't have soap that you have to dispense. So that's one less thing they have to mess with. So you wash it, you stick your hand in, you wash your hand, and then you dry it like you normally do. You know, whether it's, you know, hand towels or hand blower, it seems to be pretty, you know, interesting technology. So, it's very much.
You could put it in your, obviously in your sterilization room. You could, if you had a staff bathroom, I see that as an application. Any place, at least Han and I first talking about this, any place that you would want your clinical staff and you as the doctors and along with your associates to be able to wash up. Probably not something that you would want to see for the public, only because, you know, they're not getting into the procedures like you are. That's just general wash your hands. We all know when they go to they use the restroom or whatever, they're not washing your hands to the right amount anyways. But they're not, you know, getting involved in the level of you are. So, you know, provide them with as much hand sanitizer, whether it's, you know, like alcohol-based or the non-alcohol-based stuff, and just let them lather up that away, and hopefully they don't touch anything on the way out or the way in. But according to the literature on this product, it's, again, 99.9% of the pathogens are removed. It automatically drains out into the sewer system, so you don't have to replace any kind of stuff inside. All you do is replace the hygiene solution. It's automatic, so you basically don't have to teach anybody how to use it other than stick your hands in. And what was the other part? Oh, for the folks that care about that stuff, it's sustainable and eco-friendly in that it uses 75% less water than the manual hand washing. So you know, that's a pretty
it's
good
clean.
Deal about it. How many times do you wash your hands? Well, at least you're supposed to wash your hands. I mean, it's a lot. And so if you have a staff of 10 or 15, 75% water loss. That's pretty good. And according to test data, they're saying that it increases the hygiene compliance by up to 400%. So, you know, it exceeds the FDA regulatory requirements and the CDC requirements. And lastly, it's made in the USA. So, you know, if you're interested in it, at least go give it a look. And it might be an application for you. It might be something that would help you out. Obviously, Juan and I are going to do a lot more research on this so that in any of the new facilities, we're going to talk to our clients about the possibility of integrating this into their system to just make it a little bit easier to keep things a little bit more sterile. And they also have, probably not an application use for the dental office. It's a footwear sanitation system where you actually were to, if you had boots or even street shoes, you walk onto this unit and it sterilizes with a combination of sanitizer along with scrubbing and well as UV light to sanitize your shoes. We probably see this more in the manufacturing, pharmaceutical, cosmetic kind of stuff. And like my sister's company, they've installed those there as well. Probably not a need in the dental office. Although, Han, what have we always said? The floor is the dirtiest place in the whole facility because that's where everything eventually falls, right?
Yep. And you know, it may not be, a product that are economically sound, but there is similar technology that could help you to use as a barrier between place, between rooms like laboratory and other area of your clinical area, because when you do modeling work, there are there's clay and products that fall to the floor, and then you track it into other part of the office. Not that it's contaminated or anything like that, but it's just a matter of controlling the amount of dirt and amount of particulates that are being that being spread throughout the building, but because of the transition traffic between between rooms and space and stuff like that. So this is technology that I think that we think are worth looking at and worth considering if it's in if you're in the stage of planning. I think that we don't know have all the technical aspects of that of this this hand washing thing down yet, but we will. And if you have any questions, we'd be happy to just share that in the near future.
Yep. Well, what I'd hope to share is hands-on experience because I'm going to get it directly from my sister. Once they've gotten all these systems installed in their plants, she's going to give me a report back on just how how effective and such. And that's a lot of potential. Good possibilities. Also, for next week, we're hoping to have the investor development representative, Steve Best, back again to give us a little update on how things are going on those particular project and what's happening there, and also maybe add a little bit more to some of the things that we didn't get to cover from last week's show. So haven't got that confirmed yet, but we're hoping that will be what will happen, if not this next Tuesday or the Tuesday after. So that's not inauguration day, is it? No, that's Wednesday's inauguration. Okay, so we're good. We should have a show. We should have a show next Tuesday. At least that's the hope. Hopefully with
pre-inauguration.
The pre-inauguration day. Hopefully this has been helpful. I know Han and I enjoy this, and we're thankful that you guys listen to us. And as always, you have questions, you have comments, you know, hit us on our website, give us an email, get us on the phone. We're here to help. We obviously want to do whatever we can do to help you get the very best for your facility. So with that, thank you. And Han, I'll let you have the last word.
All right. That was fun. Appreciate everybody spending the hour with us. Like Jim said, I hope that we bring some value to your hour, and you learn a few things that you can apply. Until next time, have a great evening.
You've been listening to HJT Design Radio Straight Talk with Jim and Han. To contact us and find out more info about upcoming shows, please log on to our website at www.hjtdesign.com. Until next time.